at 351-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I Center for Advanced Study, presenting Origins of a Networked World, From World War II to the Internet, on Thursday, February 17th at 3 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
On behalf of all of us here at WILL Radio, thanks for your response during our recent membership drive. Your contributions for the week totaled more than $85,000 to be put towards next year's programs. And we now have 200 new members of the Friends of WILL. To all who have contributed in the past, who contribute now, or who will contribute in the future, again, a hearty thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this hour of the program, you'll be hearing a conversation with Dr. Zach Nsenga. He is the ambassador to the United States from the Republic of Rwanda. He was visiting the campus of the University of Illinois last week. We sat down here in the studio one afternoon and recorded this conversation. We talked a little bit about the genocide that happened in his country in 1994 and the efforts that are being made there, the ongoing effort to rebuild the country and repair the damage. We'll start the interview now. As you listen, just keep in mind that this is pre-recorded, and in this hour of Focus 580, we will not be taking your phone calls. Well, thank you very much for coming to talk with us today.
Welcome.
I would like to go back and talk about what happened in 1994. I think that perhaps some people listening will not know the story. Mm-hmm. In 1994, over a period of 100 days, something like 800,000 people were killed by their neighbors, essentially. Most of them were Tutsis. Some of them were Hutu. But they were killed by their fellow Rwandans. The precipitating event came in April of 1994 when a plane that was carrying the then president, Mr. Habyarimana, was shot down. But tensions between the two ethnic groups, the Tutsis and the Hutu, had been building for a long time. So this was the proverbial match that touched it off. Can you talk about why it is that the genocide occurred and how the stage was set so that then when this event happened, it happened? But that really wasn't the cause.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for that question. It's not true that actually the genocide started in 1994 in Rwanda. Genocide in Rwanda started way back. The killings of 1958 were characterized as a genocide by some people in the international community. And the precipitating events that caused the genocide in 1994 is not really the shooting down of the president's airplane. Mm-hmm. It is a number of other factors that you can trace from the colonial times through post-independence period and on to the events prior to the genocide. The colonial administration distorted our history. It created some of the facts that brought division. For example, the issue of identity cards to identify one and two Hutu and two Tutsi helped creating a cleavage, not necessarily between the people, but between the administration, between the leaders who came after independence. Because when the massacres of 1958-59 started, it was the colonial administration together with that mobilized some people in Rwanda against the Tutsis. And therefore, they fled into the country, those who survived. After the massacres of 1958, the government then put up what they call amnesty laws, that those who committed those massacres were not going to be put to justice. Therefore, a law was passed in 1963 and then 1974 to codify impunity. So it was this culture of impunity over a long period that allowed people to be mobilized by the media, by the leadership, and by many other things in Rwanda prior to 1994, that created a stage for a genocide in 1994. Mm. So when the president, Habyarimana, was shot, we believe was shot from his own internal organization, just to put him aside so they could, you know, kill. It was not, the genocide had started. By the way, way back in 1992 alone, there are people who had committed, who had started mobilizing militias to kill, who had used rhetoric, say, get those Tutsis, those cockroaches, kill them, cut their heads, and throw them into a river, and they go to Abyssinia, where they belong. So a stage was set before the shooting down, because the shooting down of the plane was done as a pretext to get away, I think, Habyarimana, so they could start the mechanism. Yeah.
The Rwanda had been a Belgian colony, and the Belgians ruled through the Tutsis, who were the minority. And as a result, the Tutsis took full advantage of that position. They, it is said, had the best jobs. They got the best education. And there was a good deal of resentment among the Hutus, who were the majority, about their experience during the colonial times. When the Belgians left, the Hutu became the rulers of the country, essentially. This it was the colonial experience that reinforced that division between the two people and the country to start with. Was before that time, was there much in the way of competition, resentment, violence, whatever, between Hutus and Tutsi?
No, not at all. What the Belgians did when they came into Rwanda, they used what they call indirect rule. Mm-hmm. Rwanda had been mandated by the United, by the League of Nations, to the Belgians as a caretaker. So actually they weren't there. So what they did, they ruled Rwanda from Kinshasa through indirect rule, through the chiefs, through the king. But you know, the king of Rwanda came for just a small section of the so-called the Tutsis and his chiefs. These could not have represented the whole, what they call Tutsis, because ordinary people were poor as well. So I think it was perceived because of this indirect rule. So the harsh treatment, the preferential treatment of the chief's sons and daughters to go to school, as opposed to other ordinary citizens, was seen, you know, as unfair. And indeed it was unfair. The Belgians should have had given the opportunity to everybody. But they just gave, they were interested in getting administrators, and these were only the sons of chiefs, to do that. So after independence, when they withdrew support from the king and his chiefs, they supported the movement of what they call Hutu parties to come to the surface. Just this overnight shift would not have happened if the Belgians were not partisan. They helped these militias, even at that time, to mobilize and start burning houses. They wouldn't have done that by themselves. But when the uprising came in, because the king, of course, didn't want to lose power, so he had to stage a resistance. So, and this resistance would not have been broken down if the Belgians, Colonel Gist, a Belgian colonel at that time, took side. These things are on record everywhere in these books. So he took side and they squashed the rebellion and therefore set stage for massacres of thousands and thousands of Tutsis. The followers, by the way, the followers of the king were not even Tutsis alone. Those people who went into exile included both Hutus, Tutsis, Tutsis on the other side. But it was staged that way. So why I blame the post-colonial, post-independence government was because they knew that Rwandans had lived together. You can't have a situation where people have one language, one culture, and think that this came from heaven. It is a long process of national unity that has been happening. So the governments after independence should have used these good things in the Rwandan community, one language, one culture, to put them together for the future of national unity and economic development. But what we saw, repeating what had happened in the past during the colonial time. Mm.
So the Belgians created, in a sense, those divisions, ruling indirectly through the minority, through the Tutsi. And then when independence came, it sounds as if you're saying that the Belgians wanted to maintain their influence over the government. So naturally, at that point, they would then back the Hutu, who were the majority, who came to head the government. I mean, am I hearing you right in saying?
Way back in the 50s, mid-1950s, there was a process of decolonization in Africa, in Africa everywhere. Tanzania under Julius Nyerere was one to get colonial, I mean, the British going out. The king of Rwanda, that particular King Rudahigwa, wanted also to have independence. The Belgians who had supported him didn't want this to happen. But when the movement became great everywhere, Ghana, and the Belgians were forced to arrange for a quick decolonization. But the Belgians, because of the identity cards, they were able to get the census. The census of 1920-something had identified those who had identity cards of Hutu were the majority. Those who had identity cards of Tutsi were minority. So they thought it is better to switch on the Hutus and say elections have taken place and the majority have won. But this majority were under an umbrella of a party called Parimhutu. That's Hutu party only. So for us, for most people in Rwanda, they didn't think this was a party of everybody. So we had a party that was supported by Belgians to win under Tutsi. And therefore, this government that came after became a party that was partisan indeed in its outlook and in its deeds.
I don't want to belabor the point, but I guess just to round this out, you believe that had it not been for the continuing meddling, I'll use that term, of the Belgians, that the Rwandans would have been able to sort things out and would have been able to put together a government that would have function more fairly and peacefully than the one that resulted?
Absolutely. Actually, after independence, the Belgians were no longer dominant in the politics of Rwanda. The French came on the scene because it's La Francophonie. They became more dominant after that one. So if we had one good leadership, one this leadership that was focused, at least based on the euphoria of nationalism that we saw in different countries, if there had been a good leadership and a good leadership that would have told the colonial masters that we need unity in this country, wouldn't be there where we are. I mean, every country in Africa potentially had this problem. Every country in Africa potentially could have had this problem because it was these were constructs of Berlin Conference dividing Africa in two blocks. So every country had these problems everywhere, in Nigeria. So if it was not for the leadership after independence that put together under a nationalist flag, you know, I mean, they would have this problem, but they didn't have because of the leadership. So I think the leadership in Rwanda is equally responsible for that kind of thing. The colonial administration is responsible. After independence, most leaders in Africa had these problems. They say neo-colonial, you know, we're going to coups. But if I'm sure if we had a good leadership at that particular time, we wouldn't have had what happened in Rwanda.
At this point, I'd like to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Zach Nzenga. He is the current ambassador to Washington from Rwanda and has been since the spring of 2003. We are recording this interview. That means that in this hour of the program, we're not taking your phone calls. In ceremonies last December to mark the 10th anniversary of the genocide, the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, said, 10 years on, the survivors of these gruesome crimes still suffer in silence. There has been dual survival, survival of the ordeal and survival of the aftermath of the genocide. But then he went on to say that a decade has done little to alleviate the anguish. It's been now more than 10 years. This year would be 11 years. Right. Can you talk about what progress you feel has been made, progress towards recovery from what happened in 1994?
I think the biggest progress we have achieved is in the arena of reconciliation, national unity and reconciliation. We've been able to bring all the people, including the survivors, on board to say, the only way forward for Rwanda is to reconcile. But the problem has been how to bring about this reconciliation and justice at the same time. It is a big challenge, how to balance the two. But if you look at where we were in 1994, in the abyss, deep into the deep abyss, and where we are now today, there is quite a very big progress that has been made. But that is not the only area we have focused. We have focused also on fighting poverty, because poverty also is always one of those circumstances that, you know, that nurture this hatred. Good governance, an area of good governance. We've been able to make sure that leaders in Rwanda are elected. We have even gone far, say, we should have decentralized power. Mm-hmm. Local authorities need to be elected. In the past, they used to be nominated by a president. So we want people who can be accountable to their own people who elected them. That way, it may be a bit difficult for one single person to mobilize these people to kill. We want people also to get involved. In the area we've had to reform our justice system to meet the challenges we are facing now. A lot of reforms have been done, and therefore now we are able to have access of justice to almost everyone is. So the problems of injustice can be addressed. The problem of leadership can be addressed. The problem of poverty can be addressed. Now, there is a framework, there is a mechanism. But whether this is producing results, it's a process. It will take a while. How can you fight poverty when you have a debt, excruciating debt burden? You know, whatever you get from outside goes back through paying loans. It's not being put in schools, it's not being put in health centers. So all these are the challenges. The big debt burden. We have got international support, but it hasn't been enough. This international support hasn't been enough to meet the challenges that we face after a genocide. For example, we never had, after Second World War in Europe, after the Jewish Holocaust, after European, these wars, Nazi wars, you know, United States embarked on a Marshall Plan to assist those countries. We have never got a Marshall Plan. And we are getting challenges almost of the same magnitude at that period. So a lot of progress has been achieved in area of reconciliation, in justice, in the area of economy, fighting poverty, in the area of many social, economic, and unity. You know, how can we account for the stability, for the progress that is being made in Rwanda after a genocide, if it was not for a certain amount of progress that have been achieved? So there is a lot, but there is a lot to be done. And I think that's what the president was saying. Amidst all this, there is a survivor. We are talking about reconciliation, but we are not talking about compensation. We are talking about reconciliation, we are not talking about other things that affect him. We have got women who were raped, and they have HIV. They are going to die. We have prisoners in Arusha, International Tribunal, who are getting treatment, those who raped them. But we are not helping the women. So you can see how the support we get is not the support really that is focused.
Yeah.
And there are challenges, but we are determined. So what happened in 1994 has been to us a sort of a turning point. We can't go back. We can move forward. But the speed with which we move forward must also be determined by the resources available to move ahead.
It's my understanding that now going on 11 years since the genocide, there are something like still 100,000 people, and you can correct me if that figure is not correct, in prison who are suspected of having been involved in the genocide. And I read a quote from someone in the government who said at some point last year in a newspaper story I read that at the rate things were going, that it would take 100 years to try everyone. How do you deal with that number of people that there must at least be some sort of review and you do want to hold people accountable? Given that number, how do you cope with that?
Yeah, that's true. Way back in 1998, we started addressing these issues. We had a national debate about this How do we deal with the issue of economy? How do we deal with the issue of justice? How do we deal with the issue of security and the governance? So on far as justice is concerned, we had got some experts had come from America, Australia, everywhere, and they reviewed our situation. They said, at the rate of the way things are moving, it will take you between 150 years to 200 years to complete these cases. And you know, we know that without justice, reconciliation is very difficult. So Rwandans started soul-searching themselves and they say, what can we do? And that's the time we arrived at a process that had been useful to reconciling and, you know, allowing Rwandans to live in harmony before the colonial times, and that was what they called Gacaca. Mm-hmm. Gacaca is a tradition, justice system, participatory in nature, and the purpose is to bring people, the wrongdoers, and the wronged together in front of a jury, those people with credible credentials in the communities who are impartial, who listen to these cases and help to settle them, and people would be back into society. It was a system that was never used to hang, to impose. It was a system that was reconciling. So we went for that. But because now we're dealing with genocide, we thought we would improvise it more, a little more, to deal with the issue of genocide. And the genocide criminal suspects are now categorized into, at one time there were four categories, but now there are three major categories. The ideologues of genocide, the Nazis of Rwanda are in category number one. Those people who killed, they knew what they were doing and they were, maybe they had the vigor to do it, but they never thought about the idea. And then the other category three of arson. So this process of Gacaca, we receives and judges people in the category two and three. The category number one continues into the classical justice system. Mm. So because of that process alone, there have been 42,000 of those suspects have been released to pass through this process. And the process continues. The reason why those were released, those are the ones who came forward and confessed to the crime in front of their leaders, the people, and say, we committed these crimes. This is what happened. Now, when the community judges, there is no way we can't deny it. We did it. There are many confessions. I think there are about over 60,000 who have confessed out of the 120. But those 342 have already gone. Because of the confessions alone, people will say, okay, now go to the community and be treated by the community. So already now, it's not no longer 100,000 people. They are now less than 80,000 are remaining. And the process is moving. Mm-hmm. As I'm talking now this month, we are going to have this process countrywide, looking at these cases. In a short period, instead of 150 years, we may take maybe 3 to 5 years to have this behind our back, and then the process of reconciliation continues. So this is how we have managed to deal this. This was a political decision taken by Rwanda to use a homegrown mechanism for reconciliation, for knowing the truth. Human rights activists have criticized it and say this doesn't conform to international standards. And they say, yes, we know. Because international standards, which we would have liked to use, will take us 150 years and above. So can we wait for that? Maybe our process may help us to reconcile Rwandans and see justice within our lifetime. So we know it is not up to international standards, but it works. Mm. I mean, something that releases 42,000 people from prison, is that something we should do? Rwanda and say it can't work? I mean, how would it have been possible for this report to be released and go through Gacaca?
Yeah.
So we think we have a point. We think it is not a panacea, but I think it will bring about reconciliation in our country.
I'd like to introduce again the guest for this hour, Focus 580, Dr. Zach Nsenga. He is the current ambassador to Washington from Rwanda. He was born in Rwanda, was educated at Makerere University. That's in Uganda. He has a medical degree. He also studied at University of Westminster and has a master's degree in diplomatic studies. He has served as ambassador to Israel, to the United Kingdom, to the Nordic countries, and also to Ireland, and is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We're recording this interview, so that means in this hour of the program, we are not taking calls. I'm curious to talk just for a moment about you and your background. Have you ever practiced medicine?
Yes, I did. After completing my medical degree, I practiced for 1 year in Uganda. And then I moved down Southern Africa in Lesotho. And I practiced in one of the major hospitals in Maseru, in Lesotho. So I practiced for a while. And later on, when the Rwandese Patriot Front, the party that stopped the genocide in 1994, when they started a war in 1990, I felt I had an obligation, as with my colleague, to go and assist. So I went and started working as a medical officer in, behind the lines. And then when the genocide stopped, I was nominated as an ambassador to Israel then. So I went in a different direction altogether.
So you didn't you were not a soldier, but you were you practiced as a doctor.
I practiced as a doctor, and I was taken as a soldier within the ranks of the RPA. But then I moved on to diplomacy.
I mentioned a couple of the comments, a couple of the lines from the remarks that President Kagame made last December at this ceremony to mark the anniversary of the genocide. He also said, he said this, and I am quoting him. He said, "I wish to make it abundantly clear that we Rwandans take primary responsibility for what happened 10 years ago. Having said that, however, he and many other people in Rwanda and truly around the world have said that they felt that this represented a failure of the international community, a failure to intervene to prevent the killings that, that took place."
Right.
Do you feel that, that that is the case? Could the killings have been prevented if the, let us say, the United Nations or the United States had stood up and said, stop?
Yes, absolutely. I believe so, 100%. The president was right, certainly, in saying we take primary responsibility because, as I told you, successive governments after independence, they took the route of their predecessors. And they didn't unite Rwandans when it was possible. There were potential for Rwandans to be united. They didn't do that. And they made sure actively played a very big role in mobilizing the machinery of killing. The international community that had sent had its troops in Rwanda in 1994, when the genocide started, there was a debate to withdraw these forces from Rwanda. It happened. The very day they moved them from Rwanda is the very day many people who were protected in the churches, in the stadiums, they were hacked to death. And yet, General Darere, the force commander in Rwanda, said if he had got at least 5,000 armed troops with the mandate, he should have avoided this. And I 100% agree that if there had been unanimity on the part of the international community to say the government of Rwanda stop this, they would have done so. They would have. But amidst the indecision of the United Nations and other members of the international community, these people they had a leeway. They had a leeway. But that was not the failure alone, just during the genocide. Even after the genocide, the whole government, the machinery that had committed genocide, moved into Congo. For 2 years, they were in camps being fed. How can you feed a camp of innocent refugees, but also steaming with tanks and uniforms and you leave it? At that, you keep on putting in resources for 2 years. These resources are used to train, to buy more weapons. And you allow this kind of thing to happen. That was a failure. Up to now, there are over 20,000 and over 15,000 armed groups commanded by those who committed the genocide. They are still in Congo. The international community whose responsibility is that is not doing anything. They are UN forces in Congo. They have the mandate to deal with any other dissidents in Congo, but not those who committed a genocide in Rwanda. There is no mandate even now. The failure is not then, but it continues.
Let me ask you about Congo, because as you say, after when the RPF came back and managed to stop the killing in 1994 and take control of the government, a lot of these Hutu militia, the Interahamwe, left, and many of them went into Congo. And that, in as a result of that, this conflict has spilled over the border between Rwanda into Congo twice, and two times Rwanda has sent troops into Congo. Now, it is my understanding, again, you can correct me, that a couple of years back, I think this was in 2002, there was an agreement reached between the governments of Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda to remove the Rwandan troops. And I think, though, that this was somehow conditional on the government in Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, doing something about the Hutu militia that were there. It seems just recently there have Rwandan troops gone back, or are there troops that are involved in Congo that are backed by Rwanda that are still fighting with Hutu militia who are in there? What exactly now is the official position of the government of Rwanda in regards to what's going on with these people in Congo?
Yeah, the government of Rwanda is not in the Congo. Towards the end of last year, because of repeated incursions of these groups who committed a genocide, they are called Interahamwe militias, former soldiers, or FDLR. They are still in Congo. They kept on incursions into our country, and despite all the mechanisms in place, one of them which you mentioned, and that is the Rusaka agreement, it was a multilateral. There are many actors in that agreement, different countries in the region. We signed an agreement, which agreement had four pillars, I think three major pillars. One, to have inter-Congolese dialogue, to have foreign troops withdrawn, and disarm, and demobilize, and repatriate those groups that are called negative forces, including, and more especially, the one in the genocide, the one who committed genocide. Everything, and on top of that, 2002, we had a bilateral agreement between Rwanda and Congo to make sure to operationalize this kind of thing bilaterally. So the rest of the aspect we achieved, Congo government had got a government, a transitional government. We withdrew our troops, but these militia, the ex-FAR, these negative forces are still there. Nobody has done anything about it. So our problem has been, we have an agreement. For us, we stuck to the agreement. But the Congolese government and the international community has not done anything to assist Congo to do that, or the Congolese government to do it themselves. So this is 2005, and we still have these threats, this incursion. And we are saying, why can't Congo government do it? Why can't the international community do it? The answer is, it hasn't been done. So recently, at the end of the year, they threw about six Katyusha rockets into our country. We say this can't be accepted. So we said, if nobody does this to disarm them, we will have to go into Congo. So that's why, you know, the media came up and, you know, Rwanda. Yeah, we didn't go to Congo because the international community this time said, Rwanda, don't go into Congo. We now understand. We are going to find a solution. We are now waiting for this solution. But we know African Union has come up with a statement and say, look, we have to help Congo to disarm these groups. We are going to provide the necessary troops to do that. So for us in Rwanda, we know at least now the international community seems to be engaged, and we will say we are not going to Congo because the international community is engaged, but we hope now this is the last chance. So that's what. So the position is, in Congo, by the way, there are different factions that had been fighting who are now in the government. But The problem is this, the problem, whereas they are, they have a government of transition, they have not been able to to disarm and reintegrate these forces together. So virtually each force still occupies where they were. So that's a dangerous situation. And what you hear fighting in the Congo are these groups who are close to Rwanda. We used to help them that time when before the that agreement. So they are still there and they are still fighting. These groups, the Maimais and those who committed genocide in Rwanda, because there is lack of a proper exercise of reintegrating these forces. Mm-hmm. They have never been disarmed. They have never been reintegrated. That's the problem. But Rwanda is not there. We have assured Congo we don't want to go there, but something must be done.
When the RPF took control again, and ending the killing in 1994, millions of Hutus, among them these militia members, fled Rwanda and went into neighboring countries. And I'm not quite sure what the status now is. How many Rwandan refugees are there living outside of Rwanda now in neighboring countries that are still there, that left back in 1994?
In 1996, when the Rwanda government decided to go into Congo, because for 2 years nobody was dealing with these camps less than a kilometer to our border, when the government of Rwanda went into Congo to push them further, we had those militias, those army men, they fled further west, and the rest of the refugees came back into Rwanda. And when they came back into Rwanda, those who were in Tanzania also came back. So we repatriated that particular time around. Over 1.5 million Rwandese came back. So according to the statistics by UNHCR today, about 70,000 Rwandese still remain as refugees scattered in the region and outside. So whereas we used to have over 3 million Rwandese refugees, now we have 70. That means over 95% of Rwandese have come back. They're in the country. So we still have those refugees still scattered in the region, and we think, and anyway, the information we have, some of them are diehard. They are those who committed genocide. Probably they won't want to come, but probably they will. Unless something happens, they will keep on causing problems in neighboring countries, especially in DRC, which has not yet had the overall control over the country, and stabilized Burundi as well ourselves. But 95% of our refugees have come back.
And of those people who haven't, particularly those people that you would characterize as you know, hardcore militia, people who were involved in the genocide, do you think that it's possible that those people can come home?
Yeah, they can. That's why we believe they should come. Certainly those who committed crimes will go to International Tribunal or Rwanda, certainly for that, there is no way. But those who are being recruited into their ranks, who never committed genocide, we continue to have an open arm policy to come, to bring them and reintegrate them. We are currently doing it every other day, whenever they come. We have a program with the World Bank, and those who come who have a very good package we give them, and they are integrated. Just last year, we managed to bring back one of their top leaders, overall commander, and his 110 people who came. They are integrated already. They come, and you know, we still have our repatriation commission, permanent, to keep on reaching out doors. Come back to Rwanda. The fact that you committed a genocide does not prevent you from being a Rwandan. So we still want them to come back. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if they can't, some of them are criminals and they should be arrested and taken to Arusha or even repatriated back, and we try them as well. Those who committed a genocide, we are able to know. They are known. It's not that it's everybody. That's why we are able to have Gacaca. There are those who committed a genocide, but they are not the ideologues. They will go through Gacaca here.
I think it's really fascinating as what I have read about this process, this traditional court process, which happens at the community level when you take people who are honored and respected individuals, leaders of the community. And then people come and they, accusers and accused stand and confront one another. Does that, I wonder whether people really come away with the feeling that justice has been achieved. There's reconciliation and there's justice, and I'm not sure that those two things are the same.
But look, the ideal process, ideal thing would have been to bring these people to justice. But it would take 200 years. Mm. And you see, our interest is building a community, a nation. So that's why people would say, well, it was difficult from the very beginning. At the beginning, when survivors heard that Gatata was coming, they say that one strategy of the government to release these people again. Impunity in the past through registration was done. Now this government wants to release them through Gatata. It was a battle to convince the survivors to accept this process. There has been a lot of confessions. People come and say, we want to apologize and we want to ask for forgiveness. These things have been going on. They go on every day. And we see the survivors all say, okay, now, there is nothing we can do about it. There are vivid cases, clear, documented cases in Rwanda where people have forgiven each other. It is possible. It happened. It's not a panacea. But what do you do? Do we leave it? It was a political decision taken because for the interest of reconciliation, for the interest of knowing what happened. And for the interest, before I came, you can see I was the Secretary General in the Ministry of Interior. One of our responsibilities were prisons. We were paying 3 billion US, Rwandan francs, to feed the prisoners alone.
3 billion francs just to feed?
Absolutely.
Just to feed them.
Now, this money could have gone to schools. So it's a burden also on the government. Mm-hmm. So it's a political decision that was taken to look at those things. Now imagine if you are a relative and you have people in prison for 150 years, they wouldn't be living, wouldn't be living. You can imagine the guilt, the problems of having to take food every day, So Gatata, by taking these people from prison, it brings some kind of relief to a cross-section of Rwandese. And that's why those who embrace it, they really think this is a good, fantastic method.
Yeah.
Not only for the government, but also for the relatives of those who committed a genocide.
Well, I wonder, what about the relatives of the people who were killed in the genocide? How do they feel about seeing people who may have been murderers go free?
They are worried. Because even we saw that there are some incidences where when they were released, they started, killing the witnesses. Mm-hmm. It happened. But we said, should we stop this? No, we can't stop this. These incidences have happened. We must punish them severely, but we will not stop this. So they are worried. And the most important of all is that you are more into reconciliation. You are raising these people. But not much is being done to compensate those who survived the genocide. I'm telling you one good example, that people in Arusha are being treated for HIV, those who have HIV. Mm-hmm. Those who were raped and have HIV are not getting any medicine. So those are the challenges we have with this problem. So, and we put this to the international community, please help us so that we can also cater for these survivors so that the process can move ahead. But generally, there are no longer many people who are, what should I use, the word, to generous people. The generous people are no longer very many in this world. The problems are so many. But if we really had the resources, Gatata is good, we would also take care of those who survived. I'm sure that's the double tragedy which the president mentioned. Look at the survivors. Look at those who committed genocide. So look at these things concurrently. The government, in its budget, puts about 5% of its budget to the survivors of genocide. We have called for people to put money in this, but nobody brings this. But we continue to do this as a national obligation of the government to help them. So we would like this 5% to be bigger. So that is a challenge.
I'd like to, as we have about maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes left, mm-hmm. again, reintroduce our guest, Dr. Zach Nzenga. He is the ambassador from Rwanda to Washington, has been since the spring of 2003, and also has been in the Foreign Service of Rwanda for some time as ambassador to Israel, the UK, the Nordic countries, Ireland. He also was the head of the Ministry of Internal Affairs of his country, and he's here visiting the campus. And again, we're recording this interview, so that means that in this hour we are not taking calls from people who are listening. I want to just perhaps as a way of ending up to talk about whether you feel that Rwanda is making progress toward building a kind of a multi-party, truly democratic state. Because I think that there has been some criticism that the RPF and the government of Mr. Kagame is dominating politics, is not making it possible for other parties to fully participate. And one could imagine a scenario that if enough resentment builds again among various groups in the population, that you might see some kind of return to violence. And how do you address anybody who might charge that indeed the president's party is not allowing much in the way of political competition?
I think people are so impatient. You know, just 10 years ago, we had a genocide. And one of the things we immediately realized was we had to change the governance of our country. That's why we went into decentralization. That's when we went into reforming the justice system and also constitutional making process. One of the first things that was clear and endorsed by everybody, by the citizens of Rwanda, was to have a competitive multi-party system. It had to be endorsed. It was endorsed through a referendum by 93% of the people of Rwanda. Now, during elections, it was competed by many different parties. In the coalition, during the transition period, there were 80 parties working together with Rwandese Patriotic Front to nurture the transition. So in the elections, there were three presidents opposed to this to the current president. One of the key opposition was a man who was living in Belgium for the rest of the post of the period. So what happened when he came? He found that I think the issue was, if you are in such a case 10 years after the genocide, and you are opening up like that, the chances were that it was skewed. It was seen as skewed because certainly RPF was predominant. It had stopped the genocide. It had brought all these wonderful things in the country. So naturally, people endorsed the president. But it was contested. Mm-hmm. It was contested for the first time in the history of Rwanda. So I think the endorsement of the government of Rwanda, of the current president, was, this is what you have done. Thank you for opening up. But now I think we need also the opposition in Rwanda to grow. And there's nobody whatsoever in front of, I mean, of preventing anybody from coming up. And the constitution is very clear. The code of politicians is very clear. Don't bring us back into the past. This is what it is. The safeguards are in the constitution. But everybody, parties can be formed. I think the critics were saying there were parties which were banned in Rwanda. One was MRND, the former party, and CDR, which organized the genocide. And also the other party, independence party, which is called the Party of the Bahutu, the MDR, which is Hutu Party. Mm-hmm. And because of its manifesto and others, it was that party that was along the division line. And the Rwandans say, no, we can't have such a party dividing us again. But I see really for sure that this is going to be a competitive multi-party system, but there are weaknesses, of course. And, you don't create parties by putting them there. They develop. And I think not only, maybe Kagame next time will get some position, either from RPF or, I think it evolves. I've seen it evolving. You can't have this happening, and we can't go back to this thing. Kagame has promised us that he has these 2 terms. After these 2 terms, he will go, and if he doesn't, he said, "God forbid." That's what he told people. God forbid, no third term. So, but we can't let Rwanda to United States or any other countries. We still have difficulties and problems. We are developing, but at least why was it agreed that there should be a multi-party system in the first instance? If RPF won't dominate, it wouldn't have allowed this kind of thing to happen anyway. And there was nobody saying, do it. No. So I think critics, yes, it's good, serious, but I think we shouldn't be seen as to be whiter than snow. It is a process. Rome was not built in one day. I think let's wait and see.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it there, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you very, very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, and thanks for receiving me.
You've been listening to a conversation that we taped here in our studio last week on February 9th with Dr. Zach Nzenga. He is ambassador to the United States from the Republic of Rwanda. He was visiting the campus, and we took the opportunity to speak to him, even though we knew that we couldn't do it live as we like to do, and give you the opportunity to talk with him. The program today here on AM 580 made possible in part with a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work dress and sports shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer Certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. That's it for us here on Focus. Celeste Quinn is out today, and her duties being covered by a couple of people here. Jason Croft will be along in a couple of minutes, but to start you out here with the numbers, Tom Rogers.
Thanks, David, and good afternoon. Let's take a look at the Board of Trade figures at the moment. March wheat is currently trading at $2.99 a bushel. That's down 2.75 cents. The May contract in wheat, $3.06, down 3.25. March corn is at $1.99.5. That's down 1. The May contract, $2.07.5, also down 1. July down 3/4 at $2.14.5. And the December corn at $2.30.5, down 1. Soybeans also down at the moment. The May contract, March contract rather, at $5.33.75, down 2. The May is off 2.25 at $5.34, and November trading at $5.46.25, down 1.25. In the products, soybean meal for March at $1.62 even, that's down 80. March bean oil at $19.66, down 31. The March feeder cattle contract on the Merck is at $99.90 right now, down 22.5. Live cattle for February, $89.87.5, down 52.5. Lean hogs for April at $72.90. It's the one up contract today, up 32.5. And frozen pork bellies for February, trading now at $87.05, down 60. Crude oil for May.